This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th, and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, director Barry Averidge. If you've been to the Toronto Film Festival, you've seen his fast-moving introductory clips to the festival. He has a film on how best to describe the Wassman. Barry, how would you describe him?
I think he was the man that ran Hollywood for six decades. It started with him and it ended with him.
Well, Barry's new film is The Last Mogul, which is actually a perfect way to describe him. And I just wonder for you if the title kind of came first.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, anybody who we've certainly interviewed for the film and any of the research that I've done and certainly my conclusions, you know, after making the film and spending time with all the people that were part of Lou Wasserman's life, it's a definitive statement. He is the last mogul.
If you can describe for the audience a little bit, bring them up to speed on who Lou Wasserman is and where he came from.
Absolutely. Great story. I mean, you know, Lou Wasserman, classic, you know, zero to hero story. He was a man who, you know, who grew up in the Depression era in Cleveland. And had a choice to make, like many of us or many of our ancestors did. You can take two paths. You know, he could have sat in a very overheated classroom learning Hebrew or hit the wild streets, you know, of Cleveland. Gangster, flappers, prostitutes, all that wild action that was happening in the 20s. And he chose that route. And guess what? You know, so would I. I mean, it was the way to go. Lou Wasserman threw himself into the speakeasies and suddenly found out that he had a job being a bouncer at a speakeasy. And then suddenly he graduated to booking bands for some of the speakeasies. And at the time in Cleveland, there was only one company that was booking bands for all of Capone's circuit of nightclubs. And that was the Music Corporation of America, MCA, founded by Jules Stein, who was an ophthalmologist, played the violin and chose, again, the sizzle route that Lou would, you know, become obsessed with. And Lou starts booking bands for nightclubs and high schools and gets the attention of Jules Stein. And Jules Stein offers him a job as a booker. And the rest is history. He goes on, Lou, to invent all kinds of wonderful things in Hollywood and control the industry for six decades.
It's funny, too, because as I was watching the film, and I've often thought this anyway, it's on the bios I've read on Lou Wasserman, the things you hear. For me, that Balzac quote always comes to mind, behind every great fortune is a great crime. In this case, intimations of great crime, since he was never really charged with any. And he broke the laws in many ways, and openly almost, kind of flaunting the law in some ways, didn't he?
Nothing was going to get in his way, Elvis. I think, you know, there were 10 federal investigations launched against Lou or certainly MCA Universal, and he danced his way through all of them. You know, he knew the calls to make. It's fair to say that he probably had the most powerful Rolodex, you know, in the history of any business. If there was any kind of issue, he knew how to call. He knew who to call, and if it were union people, if it were lawyers, if it were just tough guys, he knew the calls to make. When those calls weren't effective, he then, you know, put his tentacles into Washington, you know, put a B actor into the White House and controlled him. When that wasn't working, and there were some issues there, and he needed to have some other a lobbyist in Washington, Jack Valente pushed him for the job of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. Yesterday, a building was named after Jack Valente in Washington. So, I mean, this man knew the 6 degrees of separation like no one else.
And he also, too, was a studio chief who was courted by a president. Lyndon Johnson, as you make the point in the film, wanted Wasserman to come work for him.
He did. I mean, you know, Lyndon Johnson offered him, I believe, the Secretary of Commerce office. And at the time, MCA had just bought Universal. And I think Lou knew that, you know, that his fortune or great fortunes that, you know, certainly were in L.A. versus Washington. There's no question. You know, and at the same time, Lou knew that he had better influence in having people in Washington versus being in Washington himself.
It's The Treatment. My guest is director Barry Averidge. His new film on the life of Lou Wasserman is The Last Mogul. What I really like about the film, because I read a number of books on him, and the books seemed to me a little bit sort of scholarly and kind of dry. And one thing I never knew was that Elliot Ness spent a lot of time in Cleveland, and it was almost an impossible city to clean up based on what we see in the film.
For some reason, Elliot Ness got sent down to Cleveland, where another hotbed of crime, you had unbelievable migration of mobsters, not only mobsters that were born from the streets, Mo Dalitz, who ran, you know, who ran the Silent Syndicate, very, very powerful Jewish mob scene. And Elliot Ness gets kicked from Chicago to Cleveland to clean things up. And that's when, you know, a lot of the top mob guys who were in the business got out, and Lou just kept going.
One of the things that fascinates me about the movie is watching sort of show business move from kind of like criminality to respectability, watching Wasserman's career. In some ways, it seems to mirror to me Las Vegas, you know, leaving the kind of the disreputable ground roots and becoming something respectable. And he sort of pioneered that right down to dressing like somebody who you really wouldn't pay attention to. He looked like a funeral director.
Well, he wanted to elevate the business out of the streets, and there's no question. And I think, he certainly moved the business down there, and it was Vine meets Madison Avenue. He understood that these were business deals. He wasn't interested in the craftsmanship of making a film. He wasn't interested in going out and having drinks and hustling and trying to get deals done the way they are today. It was about business. He understood the channels of distribution like no one else. You know, it wasn't just going to be, you know, a studio chief. You made that reference, you know, this was a studio chief courted by Washington. But at the end of the day, all the other studio chiefs deferred to Lou. He wasn't a studio chief. He was an industry chief.
He also, too, sort of understood that basically you had to know people. And I wonder for you if you thought they got back to the fact that him starting out booking clubs, being down there basically at the very bottom, working his way up, he sort of kept those ties. And as somebody makes a point, I guess it was either Zanuck or Brown in the documentary, that when Jaws came out, he was calling those guys up all the time saying he just got the reports from speaking himself to all the guys who ran the movie theaters.
Well, it's a business about numbers. And if you take your eye off the ball and things change all the time, then you can lose a moment. So if suddenly a theater in Des Moines was off on a Saturday matinee, then you had to change it. You couldn't change the product. The product was made, but you could certainly change the marketing. You could change the booking strategy. And there's no question this man knew the art of the deal and knew the art of the business. So, and he watched it closely. I mean, he was legend in that he kept a day bed outside of his master bedroom and slept there, did not sleep in his bedroom with his wife because he didn't want to disturb her when he called the East Coast or the UK to get the numbers in the morning. And so, you know, he was all over it.
It's the treatment, I guess, is Barry Avrich's new film is The Last Mogul. I think one of the things I had to fascinate you about the story, and I've known you for a little while, is that Wasserman's life lends itself to storytelling. I mean, this big rise, being sort of mentored by Jules Stein, who then sort of lost interest because, as you said, Wasserman's utilitarian approach to doing things, when he finally consolidated Universal, basically stepped away from the talent agencies and took over a studio, he really had no bent for creativity whatsoever. And in the documentary, Sidney Pollack even says it. There were just things you couldn't do at Universal. You basically had to sort of – he said it wasn't like making sausages, but it was doing business, sort of grinding out TV shows over there.
I think at the end of the day, Lou, you know, again, it wasn't about the art. It was about business. And he took – you know, it was a carpe diem thing. He took advantage of opportunities. And if there was an opportunity for – his studio to own at one point 60% of the primetime schedule, no one else can turn it out that quickly. When television became as powerful as it was and the medium of film was on the decline, he seized the day and said, oh, my God, you know, let me start producing for television, movie of the week, miniseries, films produced especially for television, and where he owned every aspect of it. So if he produced a film for television, he sold it to television. He got a piece of the action on that. He got a piece of the action on the actors, the directors, below the line, above the line, crew, everyone that was involved with it, but held it back for syndication. So got a piece of that and then held it back for foreign. So, I mean, this he got every piece of the pie possible, and it was just pouring in.
The movie is The Last Mogul. I guess it's Barry Avrich. He's the director. But I was asking you before, one of the things I figure had to attract you to this is that his life, his career especially, lent itself to a story, didn't it?
It sure did. I mean, you know, you look at any story, and especially in filmmaking, the three acts or the four acts, and this is a great rise to power. And like every great story, it has, you know, a tremendously sad and tragic ending as well. But it's got everything that you wanted. Scandal, corruption, sex, the mob, Hollywood, the business, the deals. I mean, it's all there.
Did you ever get to meet him at all?
I didn't. I sat in a shareholders meeting of Cineplex Odeon, of which he owned a piece of, MCA owned, In fact, that's what inspired me to make the film. In 1989, I watched Garth Drabinsky again, founder of Cineplex Odeon.
Who actually sort of mirrored his – based a lot of his life on Wasserman too, didn't he?
He did. In fact, interestingly enough, Garth was the son Lou never had. Lou met him. And Garth convinced him to buy into Cineplex so that they can expand and turn into a massive movie theater chain. And Lou was quite taken with Garth's tenacity. And actually, the undoing of Garth and their relationship was the failure of Universal Orlando and that whole theme park. And Garth pretty much had enough of Lou's involvement in his life and decided to try and take back the company and do a Monday morning quarterback play, an end zone run on him, and failed. Lou basically went in and crushed Garth, threw him out, and that was the end of it. And I said, well, this is interesting. Hollywood's most powerful mogul taking on Canada's mogul. And I watched the two of them. I ended up pitching the story in 1990 out here in Hollywood, and everyone said, you're out of your mind. No one will help you make this film. No one. You will never get financing. So I say, fine. I put it on the shelf for now. We fast forward to the year 2004. Lou's been dead for 2 years. I then announce that I'm making the film without any financing or anyone cooperating, and everyone tells me immediately the same thing. We will never help you. You will never get financing. I was at the Toronto Film Festival in 04, September 04. We were just finishing our rough cut on the film, and I'm introduced by the director of the Toronto Film Festival, thought it would be funny to introduce me to the head of distribution at Universal. Tough person. And she says to me, and they say, this is Barry Average. He's making a film on Lou Wasserman. She goes, oh, you're the one. And I said, yes, I am. And she says, you'll never get it made. I said, we're finished. She said, that's fine. Well, you'll never get distribution. I said, we have distribution. She goes, it'll never get released. It's opening next summer. And she just walked away from me. And then we go full circle. I show it for Ron Meyer, the head of Universal, who, you know, who calls me and says, I got to see your movie. I hear great things. He's the only studio head I show it to. Everyone called me. Michael Eisner, Michael Nathanson, the head of MGM, everyone calls. And I say it opens June 24th in L.A. at the Arclight before it expands. That's where you'll go to see it. And they can't believe it. You know, how arrogant, this filmmaker who doesn't have a development deal, is not signed by anybody. Who the hell are you, some dumb Canadian, saying that you're not going to screen it for Michael Eisner? But Ron Meyer was interesting to me. It was intriguing because, again, Universal threw us off the lot because Edie Wasserman, Lou's widow, made the phone call and said, I don't want the studio to cooperate with this guy. Get rid of him. So we were out. And now we go full circle a year, and I have lunch in Ron's booth at, you know, on Universal and tour Lou's old office. I mean, that's pretty wonderful.
I wonder if part of this for you, too, is just the idea that this was a story that was so much about Hollywood not being able to sort of basically look at itself, you know, the want to pretend that this kind of thing didn't actually exist, that he still was a statesman, even though a lot of these things that you reveal in the film are really sort of badly kept secrets in the business.
Well, people, you know, people die, Elvis, and become canonized, and they're almost mythical in nature. The family and the industry was not interested in a camera being turned around and being the subject of this.
Did they think it was different than the books? Because there have been a number of books on Wasserman revealing a number of things too.
Yeah, three books. But a book you can choose to read. You might, you know, it might be in your peripheral vision. A film is, you know, is larger than life. And the family, 2 years after he'd passed away, was not interested in what they thought might be a rehashing of facts that the facts or as they're concerned, lies. They weren't interested. They made it very clear to me that they were not going to see this film, and nor were they going to help in cooperating making this film either. So, you know, he's gone. You know, he's considered a legend. Leave it alone.
We'll take a break and be back with more of Barry Average's movie is The Last Mogul. This is The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. We're talking about The Last Mogul, a documentary on Lou Wasserman by Barry Average. He's a Canadian. As a Canadian, what interested you in this story? Because it's so American.
It is an American story, but remember, Hollywood is universal. You'll pardon the pun. Look what's happened to our business. You know, on Monday morning when the grosses are reported, there's people around water coolers all over the world talking about that as if they're shareholders of the studio. I am not an investor in any of those studios, and yet people talk about this all the time. People love Hollywood and love, and that's primarily the media. Entertainment Tonight, Access Hollywood, Premiere, on and on and on, The Treatment. Everyone loves talking about the business. So Canadian or not, it didn't matter. This is a story that affected everybody because it's got all these themes in it. But as a Canadian, I was successful in getting it made. No American filmmaker was going to try to make the story about Lou Wasserman because we live in a town here in Hollywood called You Never Know. And agents and actors said to me, well-known ones said to me, that if I do this film with you, Barry, and then my agent calls and says we've got a deal in development with Universal, and they found out that I was, you know, cooperating with you, you never know. Every sentence ended with, you never know, I better not, you never know. And it's like, but Lou's gone. What are you worried about? But this happened all the time. Why else would I receive a phone call on my cell phone saying, stop making the movie? Who's speaking? Stop making the movie.
You actually got that call.
Twice. You know, twice. And we got, you know, bizarre calls from, you know, can we have your fax number, please? Well, who's calling? We can't reveal that. Well, you know, and then I call back on call display and it would be a law firm representing the family. And they answer the phone, Anderson, Anderson, and Anderson. Well, I know where this is going. I said, oh, hi, can I speak to one of the Andersons? And I get very lucky. They put me through to a man. He answers the phone, and I'm making the name up, Bill Anderson. I said, hi, Bill, Barry Averidge. You were just calling me asking for my fax number. One of your people were. And he goes, and just totally crazy. So he says, well, you know, Barry, what you need to understand is that the Wassermans do not want to participate in your film. I said, you know, Bill, I understand that. I said, I'm just trying to make a movie. And he goes, I understand you're doing a hell of a job, and it's a great film. Caught me off guard. And I said, well, what's bothering me is that they're going out of their way to prevent interviews from happening. And he said, well, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you know what I'm talking about. I was just on my way to interview Barry Diller, and his office called and said, I'm sorry, we're canceling the interview. And I said, well, why? Well, the family's not participating, and we don't want to do that. And I said, I got a problem with that. And he goes, Barry, you make your movie. The best of luck. And I said, do I have anything to worry about, Bill? He goes, nothing. And I never got a letter. You know, I got a letter from Casey Wasserman saying they wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't be participating in the film. And he listed all of the people that I either planned to interview or had interviewed already. On the list, the ones that I'd interviewed already. The ones I planned to interview, he killed.
He really did.
Yeah.
Because you have an amazing list of people. You mentioned Valenti. You've got Valenti. You got Sidney Pollack. You got Zanuck and Brown, whose careers were made by Wasserman, who you reached out in that same way that the Andersons somehow knew about the film. He reached out to Zanuck after he'd been kicked off the lot by his father and said, come over here, I'll make you a lot of money. You got to a lot of people. So clearly people had kind of a vested need to talk about him, didn't they?
They did. I mean, you know, I think everyone wanted to talk about him. He's affected everyone's life out here, made people a lot of money. I mean, there are people that, you know, that the ones that didn't want to go on camera still talk to me. And they tell me these great stories. And I go, come on, I'll have a crew over there in an hour. No. And they'd either say, I don't want to legitimize that SOB for one more minute, or, you know, I'm just not going to do it, or any of that. But you know, everyone wants to talk about it. I mean, we do these, you know, these great Q&A screenings leading up to the opening of the film, and they won't let me out of there. I mean, people have hundreds of questions, and certainly people like Frank Price, who ran Universal Motion Pictures and went on to Columbia, I mean, great, you know, out of Africa, some of the great films of our time, you know, is still very much touched by Lou. And everyone makes a very, you know, good point. They say, yeah, your film, you know, deals with some very, very tough issues, but let me remind you that people worked in the Wasserman era. I just went to watch Roger Ebert get his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and I was talking to Tony Danza. And Tony Danza, so he said, you know, you're the Lou Wasserman guy. I said, yeah. And he said, let me tell you something about Lou Wasserman. He said to me, Tony Danza, he said, the makeup man and the cameraman worked. He really cared about everybody, below the line, above the line. He really cared. I said, well, how do you come to Lou Wasserman? And he goes, he was my idol.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, by the way, we're talking about The Last Mogul with its filmmaker, Barry Avrich. It's The Treatment. You mentioned that Garth Drabinsky had been kind of a son to him. Clearly, Ron Meyer came up in the path not dissimilar, right down to somebody who didn't go to college, starting off in the agency business, working his way up to running Lou Wasserman's old studio. Mike Ovitz, who you have in the film, literally patterned his life after Lou Wasserman. There are a lot of guys who want to kind of, in one way or another, like Tony Danza said, either spiritually or actually apprentice themselves to Lou Wasserman.
They did. I mean, you know, Ovitz is certainly the most visible out of the Hollywood agent, empires that were built. I mean, to this day, Michael Ovitz still wears the infamous black suit and black tie.
Which he's wearing in your film.
That's right. This is Lou's trademark. And so, the only difference is with Ovitz is that, you know, he was a powerful agent that never transcended being an agent. He didn't run a studio like Lou did, and he didn't see the future. He was very good at what he did. You know, he was obviously great at pulling thorns out of paws of some of the great talent in the business and manage them. But, you know, Lou was forced to give up being an agent and easily, seamlessly moved into running a studio, finding channels of distribution that no one had ever thought even existed anymore, although he missed some big ones.
Go on cable, obviously.
Cable. He believed, and which is interesting, that, you know, some of the great people in the film told me that he did not like the idea of cable or satellite television because he couldn't control the property. If it went on to a cable or went up into the sky, he no longer controlled it, so he didn't believe in it.
So for him, it was still anything he could – and get past that quote from that Saturday Evening Post piece about the octopus. If he couldn't physically lay his hands on it, he didn't really trust it, did he?
That's right. You know, he had to have a way in and understand it and control it. Otherwise, he didn't. And that's why he was so difficult about – you know, if the phrase knowledge is power was written about anyone, it was written about Lou. I mean, he was famous for being a tough boss and great stories about agents in $2,800 Savile Row suits hugging the toilet, vomiting after they've just spent 10 minutes with Lou. And they were short meetings with Lou. He didn't, you know, they were not long meetings. There was no paper on his desk. He didn't believe in any of that, famous for that. But, if you got a lashing from Lou Wasserman, it was because he found out about something after it had happened or before one of his people knew about it. And he had to know about everything. So if he called an agent into his office and said, do you know that there's a development deal going on at Paramount? How come we didn't know about this? That agent was toast.
I guess, Barry, you're talking about this too, and you remind me of something because there is a lot of talk about show business and media and keeping up with the numbers. One thing that tends to be missing from a lot of this, and it's one of the reasons that you're here because of this movie, is there's a loss of a sense of history. You mentioned Ovitz. The one thing that Ovitz didn't seem to understand about Wasserman to me is sublimating yourself and being behind the scenes. Ovitz wanted to be the center of power and also a star, and Wasserman never wanted that.
It's true. I mean, the credo for Wasserman was that the stars get, the spotlight and the agents stay behind the scenes, when Michael Ovitz got the cover of Time magazine, that was the end of Michael Ovitz, because then your talent starts saying, what about me? And that's a huge issue. And Michael Ovitz did miss that. I mean, it's very interesting you bring up that point because the day before we were set to shoot Ovitz, and he was not giving interviews, truly reclusive. The Vanity Fair article had come out a year before, and the alleged implosion of Michael Ovitz, and crazy references in that piece. And Variety, the day before we were set to film Elvis, ran a headline that said, Michael Ovitz, Mr. Nowhere. And I'm in my car in L.A., and my cell phone rings, and I hear Mike Ovitz, and I go, oh, put him through. He goes, no, this is Mike Ovitz. I said, hi. He goes, surely you don't want to talk to Mr. Nowhere tomorrow. And I said, but I do. And so we had a conversation, and I went down, and we had an extraordinary afternoon together filming that interview. And it was an interesting interview because, he's clearly in awe of Lou, and he considers himself a disciple and considers Lou a mentor. But, many of the people that we talk to, say that, Michael Ovitz never came anywhere close to that, and as well as the fact that people do believe that Michael Ovitz sold Lou out.
Which you intimate in the film as well.
No question.
We're talking about The Last Mogul, Lew Wasserman. My guess is Barry Avrich's film is The Last Mogul. One of the things I want to talk a little bit about, we talked about Lew quite a bit here, I want to talk about the filmmaking, because one of the things I was telling you that I was impressed by before we got started is all the clips convey a real sense of motion. The clips that aren't interviews, either the camera's moving in the shot or the principals in the shot are moving. And was that key to you to sort of try to convey that sense of like momentum and velocity because you felt that was part of the filmmaking that you wanted to get across, or also because you thought that was a part of Wasserman's sort of raison d'etre?
Well, it's not so much raison d'etre, but style, personal style of Lew. He kept moving. If anybody suffered from attention deficit syndrome, I'm sure it was him. He saw everything. He got to everything. He got to everybody. And so I believe that even though the story was a long story, you know, and I did this chronological timeline of his life, which is, you know, who is in business for six decades? Who lives to 89 anymore today? So there was so much to tell, but I realized that I had to keep it moving. I mean, you know, it's otherwise you lose focus quickly and people get bored, and there are parts in that film, you know, where people aren't going to relate to certain issues. So I better have a lot of eye candy. Now, keep in mind, Elvis, as well, I come from, you know, an advertising television commercial background. You know, I've edited and directed hundreds and hundreds of commercials. I understand the medium of 30-second increments of attention span. So that's the way I've pretty much looked at the editing of this film. Keep it moving and keep it interesting. Otherwise, I'm going to lose him because it's a long story.
You almost get the sense of the film kind of tumbling over itself. The film, in a way, feels to me like a vaudeville act.
Well, it does, but that's Lew's, you know, that's Lew's life. I mean, let's look at the business today for a minute, you know, and as a parallel to this film and the way things have changed. I believe, and I'm coining the phrase, we live in the decade of distraction. The must-see in any form of entertainment is dead. No one walks out of a Broadway musical or a film and says, you got to see this.
Why do you think that is the case?
Because there's too many other things that are competing in our lives. Text messages, email, satellite radio, whatever it is, it's just not what it was. You walked out of a movie, you know, in whether it was the 70s or the 80s, it wasn't the same kind of cacophony around you. You know, it was just insane.
Let me ask you this then, because you sort of get at this in a documentary with Zanuck and Brenner talking about Jaws and him wanting to cut the number of theaters down to a third of what they wanted, or basically taking a third away, that there are people around who don't really know how to create that kind of mystique anymore, that what you're talking about is saturation. I mean, these things are all everywhere. And Wasserman still sort of got some thrill out of the fact that maybe that gets back to control, but he says, I want to see people lined up.
Well, what he's talking about, and we're talking about the story in Jaws when they realized they had a hit. And at the time, in the 70s, a wide release of a film was 600 screens. Today, it's 3,600 screens. And he wanted to cut in half to create a hot ticket. And today, there's no such thing. No one has the time anymore. You know that a film is going to DVD immediately.
My guess is Barry Avrich. We're out of time. His movie, it's The Last Mogul. It's a great documentary. It's really incredibly well made. Barry, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure, Elvis.
Our technical director is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holtz produces the program. We're talking about The Last Mogul. Get that in your heads. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.